Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is one of my favorite people, Julianne Boyd, co-founder and artistic director of Barrington Stage Company, now in their 25th very successful season. She's here to tell us about their summer lineup and much more. Welcome back, Julianne. You are terrific.
Thanks, Alan. Pleasure to be here.
I guess the first thing I want to know is that everybody understands just who you are. You're amazing, and you took a very good idea, and you made it into something that is fabulous. You send shows to Broadway with great success, and it's extraordinary to see just what you've accomplished. So let's talk a little bit about the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Easton, E-A-S-T-O-N, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, what was that like?
Boring.
Was?
Boring. I knew when I was 13 I was leaving.
Did your parents really know that also?
Yeah, they sort of kind of did. You know, I had three older brothers. You know, a couple were in college already. I knew that you could escape Easton. I mean, it was a perfectly pleasant place to grow up. But I loved theater even in junior high school, and I knew the world had to be bigger.
Were you in the play in junior high school?
I was in plays in junior high school. The truth of the matter is, Alan, I think I've never told you this. I got into theater because I had rheumatic fever in fourth grade. My father was a school principal, and he said every single student needs an activity after school. After school activities are great for kids. They stay out of trouble. My brothers all did sports, and for me, it was theater. He said, you should do theater. I was a natural. That's literally how I got into theater. And I was just in, you know, like the Mikado and all of those plays in junior high school.
I was going to ask you about that. What was your favorite?
I don't know if I had a favorite. Probably the role of Lily Bell in The Curious Savage. I think it was written by John Patrick. Wow, many years ago. But I really wanted to be a director. When I went to college, they still...
You knew that then in junior high school?
No, not junior high school. I would say starting in high school, and definitely in college, I started directing. And there were no women directors at the time. There really were no role models. So it was difficult. People kept on asking me to act, and I acted because I loved theater. College, I started to...
Well, wait. I'm not done with you yet. Did you ever do Oklahoma?
No.
Oh.
Sorry.
I love Oklahoma.
You should see the production on Broadway now. It's really brilliant.
Yeah,
really
brilliant. I can do most of it by heart by now. I love that.
Oh, I don't know.
I know.
It's not a sing-along, Alan.
I love that play. Okay, so then you go to college. Where'd you go to college?
I went to Beaver College in Glenside, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. What made you choose?
What made me choose that? My father said you can go an hour and a half away from home because we want to visit you on weekends. Very
really?
Strict Italian family.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, which is the farthest from Easton, Pennsylvania? I had applied to an all-girls school. And Beaver was, and because it was outside
Oh, they said all-girls school?
Oh, yeah, of course. And so I went to Beaver.
They didn't trust you?
No, they just thought that young women should go to women's colleges. I mean, I don't know what his psyche was, except strict. So it was close to Philly, and I saw a lot of road shows. It was really kind of exciting, and it was my first chance to see really professional theater. So I really loved it. I thought it was a great experience for me.
Did they have a theater department?
Yeah, a good theater department. And they would bring in guys from like the community or other colleges because it was an all-girls school. So it was just kind of a fun, different, can't believe that.
It wasn't like Shakespeare where...
Oh, yeah, we did Shakespeare.
It wasn't like Shakespeare where the women's parts were played by men. It wasn't in reverse of Shakespeare.
No, perhaps today it would be, except it's a co-ed college now. But no, they weren't that imaginative, I think. It would have been fun.
Yeah. Okay, so Beaver. And then you went to graduate school eventually.
I went to City University in New York. I got a doctorate there.
I knew that. And you got it in a very interesting area, which is?
Classical Japanese theater.
Classical Japanese theater. Did you have to learn to speak Japanese?
Hi.
Did you follow the president as he went to Japan?
Oh, I did. Yeah. Oh, I love the new empress. Isn't she wonderful?
Lovely. We can't say that.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Okay, so this, you followed it and you speak Japanese. Do you ever have a chance to use your Japanese?
Rarely. Yeah. We go to Japan occasionally. Last year we went to Japan. My husband's studying Japanese now. I mean, actively he studies. So he gets upset when
Has
I remember words.
Yet?
No.
He's still doing dentistry,
right? Yeah, you're still working. He's still working.
Yeah, he and I have talked about this many times, actually.
Yeah, he'll never retire.
Yeah.
He loves what he does.
Me too. I always say feet first.
Yes, right.
They'll take him out of the dentist's office feet first.
Well, our son is in with him, his brother, his brother's son. So it's a wonderful family practice.
Yeah, in New York City. Okay, and he's supposed to be an excellent dentist.
My, this is a great advertisement.
Well, I mean, we're talking about your life here. We're spending an hour. I don't want to fool around.
Right.
Okay.
That's important, actually.
Okay, so you got, and what was your dissertation on?
It was on the Bunraku Puppet Theater, which is the classical theater where the puppets are three-quarters life-size.
Three-quarters life-size?
It takes three puppet manipulators, one on the feet, one on the left arm, and the third one, that head one, is for the right arm and the head. And they study 10 years each position. It's a very traditional, old, you know.
That's unbelievable. What makes you choose that topic?
Well,
you needed one.
Why, I certainly should not have chosen a Japanese topic. That was really dumb of me. I was in my 20s and thought anything was possible. I didn't realize I had to learn Japanese, which is almost an impossibility. We were in Japan. My husband and I were visiting Japan with, we had a 9-month-old daughter, and I had seen a film on Bunraku. I loved it because I didn't believe that puppets could be so expressive. I just knew American puppets. They weren't very expressive. And I loved it. I loved the music with it. And we met in the lobby, the foremost authority on Bunraku, because he was attracted to our little blonde, blue-eyed daughter, which was very different for, you know, Japanese. This was in the 70s, of seeing someone like that. And we became friends with him. And he invited us to his house. I saw his collection of puppets. And I really learned about the history of the theater and the difficulty after World War II with the theater. I mean, it was a historical A dissertation, sort of followed it after World War II, when it sort of broke up into two groups.
That's so interesting. So, Julianne Boyd, so tell me, that's right, you wrote it after World War II. And of course,
I better have written it after.
Well, no, I know, and we used the atom bomb, and we did all of that stuff, and you had to deal with Japanese people. What were you hearing?
Well, this was in the 70s, so we're talking, you know, 30 years later. They loved Americans. They absolutely loved Americans. I spent a lot of time in Osaka, in Tokyo. And then I went back. We lived there for a summer. And by that time, we had two children. We lived there. And I studied at the National Theater of Japan. It was a tremendously exciting experience. The thing that I love about the Japanese culture is that it is so very different from ours. It's so exotic. And yet it's so, there's something about the orderliness of it that I find is not part of my everyday life that I like to experience in another culture.
Yeah. Do you like sushi?
Oh, I love it.
Me too. Boy,
I know.
I tell you, I love it also.
It's like candy to me.
Yeah.
It really
It's extraordinary. Did you ever go to the Japanese fish market while you were there?
Tsukiji, all the time. Last year we were there. We went three mornings. Again, it's one of the most exciting experiences. If anyone goes to Japan, they must go to the Tsukiji fish market.
Gotta get up early.
But, you know, you don't really have to because they sell the fish early. But those restaurants with the freshest fish you'll ever get are really open all morning. That's what we learned this time.
Well, that's interesting. And, of course, one big tuna can be worth a lot of money.
They're big, aren't they, Alan? They're gigantic.
They can be worth a lot of money. Okay. So now you're through with your dissertation. What do you do with it?
Well, that's a good question, because I had no desire to continue because I spent so much time learning Japanese, and I actually had to learn to read it. So that was really, really difficult. I had to use a dictionary a lot, you know, to look at the kanji up and so forth. I really wanted to be a director, but they weren't hiring women directors in the 70s in New York. But I got a job at the Classic Stage Company, CSC Repertory, as the assistant to the artistic director, Chris Martin, which meant everything from cleaning the bathrooms as an assistant, you know, in the little off-Broadway theaters way back when, to running the sound, which meant the tapes, the reel-to-reel. Unbelievable. And finally, he had a pile of scripts that had been submitted in the corner. And he goes, look, Julie, I can't read them. If you can get through them, I know you want to be a director. I'll tell you what, I'll give you a late night slot, 11 o'clock at night. Just find a play you like, and you have a budget of $500. I said, okay. And I found a play I liked. You ready what it was called? I'm embarrassed to say. The Pool Hall of the Heart.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, my God. I can only imagine how bad it was. But I did it. I cast it, and it got a great review in the Village Voice, which sort of is that thing you need. You need to have confidence when you start a career, particularly in theater. and even one reviewer or a couple of reviews or a couple of people saying really great things to you can keep you going for an unbelievable length of time. And so that was sort of the beginning. And then I started being offered other small productions, never with pay. Until I did UB on Broadway in 1978, I was never paid a penny.
And UB was yours?
UB was mine. And I conceived and directed
it. How did you get that?
Well, cabarets were in at the time. You know, they were starting to do like the work of Harold Arlen, the work of Fats Domino, of Fats Waller. So I borrowed actually a copy of Shuffle Along, the first Broadway musical by a black person, UB Blake, and from the Woodstock Library, believe it or not, because we had a tiny house in Woodstock, and I went to the library and I said, UB Blake, I'm just wild about Harry. He wrote that. I was just so surprised. So I listened to this long playing record. I loved it. And I love jazz. I've always loved jazz. So I took it to the Manhattan Theater Club, and I was reading scripts for them, and they said, oh, this is such a great idea, but we're doing another cabaret this year by someone of the same era, Fats Waller. They were doing it, Misbehavin'.
Sure.
And so then I took it to another little theater. I don't know how I knew them, Theater Off Park, which was like 34th Street between Park and Madison. And they said, great, it's Black History Month. Let's do it. There always had to be a reason. No one, could you just do it because you love the work? So we did it there. And I had to get in touch with UB Blake to be able to get the rights to do the music, which meant I had to get in touch with Marion Blake, the Gorgon at the gate, who became one of my best friends. But she was so used to people trying to take advantage of UB Blake. And I called her and I said, you know, I wanted to do this review. And she said, well, what'd you think of the book? And I said, well, I can't find the book. I don't think it exists anymore. And even if it did, I have a feeling it was racist. She said, great, fine, you can do it. It was racist. Just from my research, I could find that
this
it was.
A book on UB.
No, on Shuffle Along.
Oh, Shuffle Along.
And it was a bunch of sketches. It was really a bunch of sketches. But it was so vaudevillian. I knew at that period, which was like 1919. And from what I could read, it really was, we didn't want to do the book. And it was just in bits and pieces anyhow. So we did the review. UB Blake came opening night. He lived in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy.
Now, he's passed now, right?
Yeah. I met him when he was 96 and I knew him.
Whoa.
He was 95 going on 96. And he died when he was 100.
Wow.
And we gave a big birthday party for him, 100th birthday at the Schubert Theater in New York. And he died just a couple months later.
Wow.
So anyhow, so UB was there opening night. And the critics were there because UB Blake had become popular. You know, Johnny Carson had discovered him again. And he became a popular jazz pianist. And as the lights went down, he said, now we're all the same color. And it made the paper. It made page 6 in the Daily News. It made everything. I mean, he was just, he was so sharp. He smoked a pack of cigarettes a day, by the way, till he died.
He would have lived to 110.
Yeah. Otherwise, that's right. That's right. So anyhow, so that was the beginning. And then it went from this small show I did at this small theater. We enlarged it to take it to Broadway. And it went to Broadway. This was in February. By May, I was in rehearsal for a Broadway show, getting paid, and I had never gotten paid in theater before.
How did you put that together financially? Did you have to find the money? Did you have to do all those things we hear about? Rent the theater, find the money, get the producers?
Well, when we did the little small production, there was a small nonprofit theater.
Yeah.
But when the show, the New York Times gave it a great review, and everyone gave it a great review, so I had lots of producers coming down to see it. So I chose a producer who then took it over. I mean, I did not know.
Yeah.
That only thing I did know is to get the rights, because Marion Blake had said to me, if this works, you can get the rights. You'll get the rights, which was great. But then I had Warner Brothers own the music. And then I had to go to Warner Brothers to get the music. And I had a, you know, entertainment attorney do that. But a producer really has to produce that. I didn't know how to produce a show on Broadway. We took it out of town to Philadelphia. So I did it as a small, tiny production in February. By May, we were in rehearsal. And we spent the summer in Philly at the Walnut Street Theater with Gregory Hines, Maurice Hines. It was like the dream summer of a lifetime.
Wow. Okay,
great.
So that's the beginning.
That is the beginning.
Then what?
Well, then I did a number of UBs and so forth. I then did a show called My Name is Alice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a review, a women's review that showed that women had great senses of humor at a time when women's lib people didn't think that they did. And then I had a third child, and I decided that I didn't want to work out of town, that it was really difficult. My two children were much older. And so someone told me about an opening at the Berkshire Theater Festival. I'd never been to the Berkshires before. Never. Mm-hmm. By the way, in the intervening time, I worked at the Old Globe a lot. I worked at theaters all around the country because regional theaters were really coming in. As Broadway was shrinking regional theaters. But taking this 2 or 3 or 4 year old with you is different than when they're in school and you have to leave them in New York. So I was at Berkshire Theater Festival for 2 years, and I love the Berkshires. And one of the things that I really wanted to do was more year-round theater. I just felt we had to do something for the people in the Berkshires. I mean, it was great having tourists.
Wait, I have to go back here for a second.
Okay.
Julie. There was one unhappy experience at the Berkshire Theater Festival, wasn't there?
There was, but you know what? It ended up being the best possible
thing. And that's what happens to all of us.
Isn't it, though?
Negative stuff.
Yeah. It ended up being kind of fabulous.
You pushed the envelope, didn't you?
Yeah, I pushed the envelope because I really believed that we needed something else in the Berkshires. We needed year-round theater, or as much year-round theater as we could have. At the time, nobody was doing productions in the fall. Nobody was doing things in May. It was basically sort of the third week in June to the third week in August. And then we used to say, Alan, remember, then we fold up our tents and everybody goes away until the following June. But people would be coming up to me and saying, why don't you do theater year-round, or why don't you do it in the fall? There are a lot of us here. And I thought that made sense. So with Susan Sperber, who was the development director at Berkshire Theater Festival, and I started this theater in her dining room. Literally, we started, like, we filled out a 501c3 form and so forth, and got together a wonderful small board headed by Marianne Quinson.
How'd you find her? Because that became quite a partnership.
Yeah, a wonderful partnership. She was on the board the last year I was at Berkshire Theater Festival. She was on the board.
Yeah.
And so I got to know her, which was kind of wonderful.
And now there's a stage named for both of you together.
Yeah.
At your place.
The Boyd Quinson Main Stage.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's been very, very exciting. So we started our very, very humble beginnings were at Mount Everett High School, the Consolati Performing Arts Center.
I remember it well.
Yeah. And it was way bigger than we wanted. It was 500 seats. We were looking for a 100-seat theater. Well, we couldn't find one. We looked in every open space, every garage, every meeting place, but none of them had, the ceilings weren't high enough to have stage lighting, and we would have been very, very limited. So when we went down to the Consolati Performing Arts Center, my hero and mentor really is Tom Consolati.
He's
a great, great guy. And when we went down and we said, would you be interested or would you rent us this space? And he said, I can't think of anything I'd like better. He said, schools should be a community center. Everybody pays taxes in the city, in the town, wherever you are, or in the several towns. And he goes, everyone should have the use of this space. So if you use it, we will be able to bring in people who maybe don't have children.
And they're taxpayers.
So he said, I'd love this to be more of a community center, and I would like the young people to think of this, a school, as a place where they can go and not just, they're going to be tested. Some kids get stomach aches thinking of school because they're not the best students in the world. He said, wouldn't it be great if they could come in and enjoy a play, just be entertained? So I just thought that was just what I wanted. And then he said, I think that I would like children 13 years and younger to come in for free. And I thought about it for like a nanosecond and said, okay, but they have to be accompanied by a parent because I don't want this to be Camp Barrington. And also, it had to be children who were a certain age. I don't know what it was, 5 or 6 years old. And it had to be an appropriate play or musical. Then he said, well, how about teenagers? And I said, half price? He said, yep. Literally, we made the deal and shook hands in a half hour. And he never went back on his word. He was fabulous. And he understood the role of arts in the community and with young people.
Of course, there were limitations. I mean, obviously, you couldn't do it when school was on, right?
That was a severe limitation. It wasn't to begin with. We were just happy we had it.
Yeah.
And, we didn't have a very big audience, and we didn't have the kind of shows we wanted to extend. But as we moved on through the years, we were there 11 years, it became obvious, like, if we had a show in August that was a big hit, it had to close. And there was no possibility of extension. And it was a very tight schedule. It was like 8, 9, 10 weeks, depending on what year it was. Mostly 9 weeks or 10 weeks. And we started looking for a theater probably around 9 years. Didn't find it till 11, to our 11th year. We had 11 years down there. But it was a wonderful experience. And then we used, they had two cafeterias. We used the, I think, the elementary and middle school cafeteria for a stage two.
Really?
And then we,
so you had a stage two that early?
Well, Spelling Bee started there.
Interesting.
Yeah. We had a stage two our second year, but it was small. It was very small, and it didn't. And then it just kind of it grew a little bigger. So by probably our fourth or fifth year, it was a real stage two.
So everybody has to understand who's listening to this now. Where exactly we're talking about? Sheffield, Massachusetts, is south of Great Barrington. Then there's Great Barrington. Then you head up, you get past Lee and Lennox, and you go up to Pittsfield. We're gonna remember that, folks, because that's going to be important in this discussion.
Right. And Sheffield is a rural community.
Yeah.
I mean, we were on a country road, and we weren't sure people would go. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite stories is my stage manager, who's still our stage manager today, Renee Lutz, and I used to count the cars in the parking lot. The first year when we did The Diary of Anne Frank, there were 25 cars, and then it grew and it grew, and then you know, we did well. But it's still 500 seats was difficult for us to fill in the location we were at. And some people felt, because we were in a school, that it couldn't be great professional theater. They just had something against it being in a school. I remember, though, Jerry Herman, who wrote Hello, Dolly, and Mac and Mabel. We were doing Mac and Mabel, and Jerry came to some of the rehearsals and the opening, and he was thrilled to be there because he loved Mac and Mabel so much. And I said to him as we're driving, you know, toward the school, I said, now remember, it's in a school. It's in a high school. And he said, Julie, I don't care where it is. Is it a great production?
Yeah.
And I started thinking differently about it. Like, and actors would come at first, and they would kind of look askance at, like, where are we? You know, you mean the chorus room? One of the chorus rooms is my dressing room? And then they loved the actors. They loved the productions. And that was kind of wonderful.
Was it Actors Equity from the beginning?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was professional. But we paid, like, you know, bupkis then.
So now you're there. You have the wonderful Marianne Quinson, and you have to decide what comes next after those 9 years, and you're looking around for something better. And then you make an incredible decision, which really offended a lot of people. You decided you're going to take that theater and you're going to put it up way to the north in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, with the name Barrington Stage.
Correct. We had no choice. Because we looked for 2 years, probably even a little more. We looked at every building in South County, Great Barrington, anywhere around there, and we could not find the space that we wanted. So how did this really happen? I saw a show at the Berkshire Music Hall. Susan Sperber was head of the Colonial Theater at that point.
I remember her.
And she invited us to see their playing her song at the Berkshire Music Hall, it was called. And I went in and I went, wow, there was something about the relationship of the stage with the audience. It's very intimate. It goes back 10 rows in the center, 11 rows on the side. And we were in a space at the Consolidated Performing Arts Center that was 26 rows. So it was like yelling your lines for the actors just about.
So name the place you went into there. What was it?
Berkshire Music Hall.
The Berkshire Music Hall, which did it have any other incarnations?
It had before that the Berkshire Public Theater. Then it was a movie theater. It was an X-rated movie theater, I heard. But then a regular movie theater. And to begin with, in 1912, it was a vaudeville house.
And it always had a weak roof, as I remember. There was always water coming in.
Well, there certainly was when we got it. It was a handyman special, you know, doubled or tripled. But we just loved it. So what happened was that the guy who owned it, a guy named Ray Schilke, was a sound designer from New York. And he was trying to fix it up, and he couldn't. So we decided we were looking for a space, and we decided, why don't we rent the Mehewi? We'll see how the Mehewi is, and the Berkshire Music Hall, just to see where our audience is. And we did Hair. And we ran it for 1 week at the Mehewi, really nice audience.
Now, the Mehewi, for everybody who's listening, is in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and is now the center, the vortex of Great Barrington.
It's a fabulous theater now. It is unbelievably wonderful. So we rented the Mehewi for 1 week, and we rented the Berkshire Music Hall for 1 week. We were so sold out in Pittsfield that we had to run another week. We extended it. But there was a problem because Ray Schilke, he didn't have a C of O. We didn't know that or whatever, you know. And so we had to have a fire. We had to have a fireman there every single night because it didn't pass the fire inspection course, he didn't tell us that we rented it, you know. And we just said, okay. And we couldn't use the balcony. We had to keep everyone on the floor and have firemen there. I don't know how the audience wasn't scared when they saw firemen there in uniform. But we did it. But by that time, by the time we were doing Hair, we knew we wanted it. And Ray said, please buy this theater for me.
Really?
So we bought the theater in the accompanying.
How much?
I have to think how much it was. Do you know, I can't remember right now. I get so many prices in my head. It was between $600,000 and $700,000. So it's about $700,000.
So did you get a deal?
Well, I don't know if we got a deal or not. I mean, it's a deal because it's our home and we love it and it's worked out.
And a lot more, but let's go.
So then we also got the Octagon House, an octagon-shaped house, 3,500 square feet, that was next to the theater that we realized we could use as our office. Now, it was a burnt out drug house. I mean, a crack house. And literally, floors were missing. It was just unbelievable. The first thing we did was we renovated that so we could have an office while we were doing the theater.
Sure.
And then we renovated the theater.
How'd you get the money?
Beg, borrowed, and did not steal. But we had a couple of wonderful, large supporters. The city of Pittsfield gave us $500,000 from the GE Fund, and we raised money. And then we had a big mortgage. And it took us years to pay it off. We bought it in 2005. We started our campaign in 2006. And of course, in 2008, with the economic downturn, it became really difficult. And it took about two more years before everything popped up again and people started donating.
Well, now, Julie, a lot of people were ticked off that you took the Barrington stage and put it in Pittsfield and said, we're not going to go. But they did.
Well, what happened was the theater wasn't ready the first year. We opened in August. So we were in two different places. We were at Berkshire Community College and at Lenox High School for the first two main stage productions. And we were in the library, the Athenaeum, for the stage two.
That's in Pittsfield.
In Pittsfield, yes. And then the second year, we had the entire theater was renovated, the mezzanine and the orchestra, and we did West Side Story. And when we did West Side Story, a lot of people came back. So people from South County who were upset then came back, and it became just 10 minutes north of Tanglewood.
Sure.
And we sold that. That's what we had on everything those years, 10 minutes north of Tanglewood. So they didn't feel as if they were going to a foreign country when they were going to Pittsfield.
We are talking to the wonderful Julianne Boyd, founder and artistic director of the Barrington Stage Company. Okay, so now you're there, and you have a focus unlike anybody I've ever seen. You just focus, and you know what you're doing. So take us back to the story.
So one of the things I realized, and this isn't anything that I excelled in my earlier years, meaning until I was 50, is patience. You really have to be patient when you're moving to a new community and you're trying to get people who haven't been to the theater, get them involved in theater, and let them know that we have this great professional theater. And so I can't say how it happened, but we started doing great work and people started coming. We got very involved in the community because we had already started a Youth at Risk program, the Playwright Mentoring Project.
Youth at Risk?
Yeah, okay. In 2000. And we had brought it up in 2002, we had brought it up to Pittsfield. So we're already in Pittsfield in that area, and it kept on growing.
And Pittsfield is a very challenged city.
It's a very challenged city and still is. It's certainly on the up and up. It's doing much better than we moved there. When we moved there, there were stores that were boarded up.
Yeah.
And people from Pittsfield would say, well, you're not going to stay. You're going to see. It's not happening here. And people from Pittsfield said that. We were so astonished. Then my husband and I bought a house in Pittsfield, and that's when it turned. They realized we were going to stay. There was something about, settling down right in Pittsfield. That was important.
Okay. Because we want to get to the season now.
Yes, we do.
Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Finn.
So when we did Spelling Bee in 2004.
And which went to Broadway. Did you make money from that?
Oh, yeah. That's how we moved. I mean, the move from Sheffield to Pittsfield cost a lot of money. We had to move our whole set shop. We had to move everything. And so we did. So Bill.
How much?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember. I would, at that point, it was probably, I mean, it was a lot. Okay. It was probably $750,000.
Wow.
Which goes not very far when you're moving and setting up in a community where nobody really knows who you are.
Sure.
And you have to do publicity. And the theater was, oh, by the way, so this $700,000 theater, let's say we bought, The campaign started at $6 million and ended up at $8 million. So all of a sudden, we have this gigantic, you know, things always cost more than you think they're going to, right? And so we found out that the theater had structural problems. We had to fix them. So now we're just thrilled with it. So back to Bill Finn. So he suggested that we start a musical theater program for writers who weren't famous.
How did you meet him?
Well, I had met him because we did falsettos, like in 2002, I think it was, maybe 2003. And he and his partner were renting a house, I think in Austerlitz. And he was invited to a rehearsal. And I always say, Bill came to rehearsal falsettos and never left. He loved what he saw. He came to several, I think he came nightly almost, to falsettos. And then he did a reading with Chip Zion there. And then the following year, he called me and said, I have this new musical I want to develop, but I need to develop it in the winter. And I said, oh, Bill, in the winter here in the Berkshires. Okay. And I was going to Japan. It happened to be I was going to Japan the month he wanted to do it. So we moved it a little bit. We adjusted the schedule. I had a great associate at the time who took over. So we developed it. And then his wish was that we look at other writers, particularly young writers. He was teaching at the NYU Musical Theater, the master's program. And he said, you know, we do stage readings, but that's it. We never get past the what we call music stand. Everything's on a music stand. They're reading them.
And this was for which property?
Spelling Bee.
Spelling Bee. Right.
Yeah, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. And so we started the musical theater lab in the basement of the Athenaeum in Pittsfield. The ceilings were about 8 to 9 feet high. We couldn't have too many. We couldn't have any big lights because the actors were like sweating. You can only imagine how close they were. And we just started. We started developing new musicals. We were known for musicals because we had done big musicals. You know, especially with Cabaret. Cabaret, our third year, moved into Boston, moved to the Hasty Pudding. Our Follies production got written up all over in the New York Times. So people knew us. So it was a little easier to go from doing known musicals to new musicals. What people didn't know in our development was the straight plays. We thought when we went to Pittsfield that we didn't know what kind of plays the audience would like. In 2009, we did Freud's Last Session.
I saw it. It was great.
Yeah, by Mark St. Germain, a conversation between C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud. And I went, okay, Mark, this is great. It's really heady. We can run this 2 weeks. This is what our audience is going to like. We ended up running it 10 weeks.
Everybody knew about Freud.
Everybody knew about Freud. And there was something about that conversation that people just tune into.
Now, those guys never met each other, however.
That's correct.
However, it was quite a production. Yeah.
There was a book by a man named Nichols from Harvard who wrote about the hypothesis of what if.
What if.
Yeah. And so we ran it 8 weeks. We ran it 6 weeks that summer, 2 weeks in the fall. The following year, we brought it back on its way to Off-Broadway. We got it ready for Off-Broadway. We got the set ready. So all of a sudden now, we're starting to get known for plays, which I loved. So that, you know, musicals take a long time to develop. They're very expensive. They often take workshops. And then there's musicians and choreographers and musical directors. And the plays are a little bit more contained. We started developing plays, which was great, great fun. And also something we could do. And then the stage two ended up being very much about social issues and relevant theater. And it's something from my probably 60s hippie days that I loved, that I could connect with, you know, theater that was entertaining, but by this point we had an audience who loved to think, who came to the theater to be exposed to different worlds, and we've really been developing that audience in the last few years.
Okay, so great successes, and we've left a lot out, but Julie, it's amazing what you've accomplished. So now let's talk a little bit about what people can expect this
season. Okay, so we had a contest called the Terry and Berman New Play Contest. We were trying to find like a really great new play. And we had a contest. The winner would get $25,000. The two runners-up would get $5,000 each. And the Berman supported this play because I felt that we weren't getting enough great new plays that oftentimes bigger theaters in New York or major cities could pay bigger commissions to get these writers to write plays for them. And we didn't have that ability. So we had 461 plays submitted. We read them all. We read 70 of them three times, and we ended up with three fabulous winners. So this year, about half of our shows are world premieres. The one that won that contest is by a playwright named Stacey Rose, and it is called American Version 2.1, The Sad Demise and Eventual Extinction of the American Negro. and it is an explosive play. It is a brilliant play, and it couldn't be more relevant. It couldn't be more relevant. And it's basically about four black actors who are hired, sort of like, you know, like at Williamsburg, where they hire you to read, where they redo history. You know, they'll do a, like a little play, or Paramount, this movie theater. Well, this is, someone has hired these black actors, someone white, and they are now acting out revisionist history written by a white person or a group of white people. It's funny, it's dynamic, it's exciting, and you've never seen anything like it.
Have you hired the cast already?
Oh, yeah, they're in rehearsal. They're in rehearsal. Wow. It's kind of fabulous. And, you know, I think somewhere you got to push the button. I think our community is a diverse community, which is exciting to me. And
Pittsfield certainly is.
Yeah, in just a wonderful way. To me, it's, I mean, because I also live in New York City, it's a microcosm of, I think, of what I see a lot.
Do you see this going to New York?
I don't know. We're just trying to get it up. It's a world premiere. I think it will have a life after this. I do think so. And I think it's Brave Theaters that will do this play. And so I'm very excited about doing it. We're also doing, in the fall, we're doing one of the other winners of this contest. It's called American Underground, written by a Persian-American writer, Brent Askari. And it's about a family that, it's in the future. Both of these plays take place in the future, which I find very interesting. The playwrights almost aren't writing about today. They don't know how to write about today. And of all these plays that were submitted, we had maybe 25 comedies out of 461. Mm. People aren't thinking funny, and they're not writing about today. They don't know where today is landing. Who knows? So this play is about a government at this time in the future is capturing and killing Muslims. And this family is part of the American underground that is hiding Muslims. And a young Muslim woman comes to the door, and they decide to hide her. And a little while later, a government official knocks on their door. It's a thriller. It's actually not as political as it sounds. It's a real thriller. But it's exciting, and I can get behind it, and it's relevant. And that's the kind of theater that I want to do. We're also doing a new musical. Now, this is funny. It was hard to find funny. Fall Springs, which is in our August slot in the main stage. It's a musical about fracking. Actually, a musical. It's sort of like Urinetown. You know, it's wonderful. It's about this megalomaniacal woman who finds essential beauty oils in the ground. So she fracks under this town. And as she fracks, the town starts collapsing. So it's funny. It's on her main stage. We couldn't put that on her stage, too. It was too difficult. So those are like three of the really, you know, I think, astonishing ones. We're also doing a new, this is not in the order of the season, by the way. We're starting with Into the Woods on the main stage. Okay, which is mid-June to mid-July. Into the Woods, Stephen Sondheim, James Lapine, brilliant, brilliant musical. Just went into rehearsal today. The second play is Gertrude and Claudius, which is a Mark St. Germain.
Talk to just a second about Mark St. Germain, because he's one of your great assets.
Yes, he is. He was an original board member back in 1995. I've known Mark since the early 80s. And he has written so many wonderful plays. You know, people think of him as writing historical, you know, because of Freud and C.S. Lewis, Freud's Last Session. But he wrote Dancing Lessons about a young man with Asperger's, which is so brilliant. Funny, a comedy about him falling in love with a dancer, this man with Asperger's. He wrote Best of Enemies, which was a play about the desegregation of the North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina schools in 1971. I mean, wow. Based on the book, The Best of Enemies. So this year, he wrote Gertrude and Claudius, based on John Updike's book, Gertrude and Claudius, which is a prequel to Hamlet. So it's how Gertrude and Claudius met and fell in love. And it's a hot, passionate love story. Brilliant, because Updike is brilliant. And put Mark with Updike. It's kind of fabulous. And that's mid-July through the first week of August. And then we do Fall Springs, which is a musical about fracking, for the rest of August. And then American Underground, the Muslim play I told you about in the fall. Right now, and our stage two, since we open it in May, is Hold These Truths about the Japanese-American Gordon Hirabayashi, who was, when his family was sent to the Japanese concentration camps during World War II, he refused to go.
Very important play.
It's unbelievable. It's really important. And he fought it all the way to the Supreme Court and lost in the 1940s. It was overturned when they found out that the government, the War Department, had withheld evidence to the Supreme Court. The verdict was turned over in the 80s, and I think 1987. And it's a play about, I wanted to do it because I don't know where our American heroes are. Where are they? Maybe we have to go back in history and be reminded of a great American hero and the importance of the Constitution.
Was your Japanese training helpful in choosing this?
Well, the backstory is I know the writer, Jeannie Sakata, because she was in a play I directed called T-E-A, about Japanese war brides. 30 years ago, she was in this play, and we have kept up with one another. Not, where are you? If I'm in L.A., I'll see her because she's in L.A. And I knew she had done this play. I saw a very early version of it in L.A., and I sort of kept up with it. And I just felt this was the year to do a play like this. The actor is Joel De La Fuente. He's a brilliant actor. And it's a one-person show, and he goes through Gordon's life from the time he was little until he was a sociology professor, and when the verdict was overturned in 87. You should come see it, Alan.
I'm going to.
Yeah, it's playing two more weeks, I think, through June 8th. Then we're doing The Sad Demise, you know, American version 2.1, which is June 14th to the 30th. Then a comedy, Time Flies.
Tell us a little bit about The Sad Demise.
Well, it's, as I said, it's sort of about the day in the life of this troupe of black actors who are acting out. Yeah, that one. And it's very exciting. It's very exciting. And I like to do plays where I learn and I continue to learn.
Sure. What are the dates on that?
June 14th to the 30th. Then we're doing Time Flies and Other Comedies by David Ives, the very, very funny. You know, he did All in the Timing, Venus and Fur, which isn't so funny. But his one acts are hilarious. And we're putting together a series of one acts that Deborah Jo Rupp is in, Jeff McCarthy, some of our regular. You know, one of the great things I think we've been able to do is have associate artists. We have artists that appear again and again at our theater, and they become associate artists. And we talk to them about what roles they would like to play every year. Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't.
So this is almost a repertory staff?
Smaller. We could never do a whole repertory theater. I would say we probably have 10 actors. They're directors, designers that are associate artists, other people too, musical directors. But Deborah Jo Rupp and Jeff McCarthy are much beloved by our audience. So we're doing that July 5th through the 27th. Then a really interesting play called If I Forget by Steven Levinson. It was done a couple of years ago in New York, and it's about a contemporary Jewish family that has two different views of Judaism. A 75-year-old father and his three children. And the son is the head of a Judaic studies program in an unnamed university in New York. But he thinks that the older Jews are concentrating too much, is thinking about the Holocaust. And they have to get away from the Holocaust. And they have to think of what Judaism means today. But he doesn't have an answer to what that is. And so he wrote this book about that. Sort of, do you know what epigenetics? It's a bit like epigenetics that, you know, if you experience some trauma, it follows you. It follows your bloodline, so to speak. And in the play, the 75-year-old father, who's been very quiet, gets up and gives this speech. And he says, I was in World War II. I freed the Jews in Dachau. Don't ask me to forget. I will never forget. And the play is called If I Forget. And so one of the things that I wanted to do when I had this play, and it's funny and it's touching. It's so many things. And I got in touch with Rabbi Josh Brindel, who was at Anshi Amunin, the temple in Pittsfield. And I said, would you read this play? Tell me, what do you think of the view of the contemporary Jews, particularly this young man who is a professor and a little lost? And he said, Julie, this is a discussion we have to have. This is a really important discussion. So Rabbi Josh is going to come and give a talk on a Sunday before the show opens, and then we're going to have discussions. He's coming in to meet the cast and so forth. So again, it's a world that I wasn't familiar with, you know, both generations, certainly the older generation I was. So that's our season. We have a lot of other things, like Gail Nelson is coming this next weekend. Gail Nelson opened the theater with Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill 25 years ago at the Mackinac Inn. And she's going to be in Mr. Finn's Cabaret this weekend singing Lady Day.
It's amazing. How has the city of Pittsfield taken to you?
Well, we have a great relationship. You know, we're now right in the center of Pittsfield. We had very generous donors, Jesse and Bernie Wolfson, who gave us the money to buy a building. It's now called the Wolfson Center, and it's 28,000 square feet. So we're able to have our rehearsal spaces, our administrative offices, our costume shop, right in the center of Pittsfield, which means people walk by, there's foot traffic, they come in, they talk to us.
It's a beautiful building. It's a big building.
It's a big building. And it's.
And why did the Wolfsons do this? You asked them?
Yes, I did. Bernie Wolfson's parents, many years ago, many, many years ago, honeymooned in the Berkshires. And I think they spent time in Pittsfield. And he's always had a very soft spot for it. They had a house. They still do. Bernie passed away last year, but his wife, Jessie, they have a still has a house here. And I think he knew they could make a difference in Barrington Stage. It's made a difference in the way we collaborate with one another. The entire staff is in one building. Before, we were like in three different buildings. We far outgrew the 3,500 square foot octagon house. We
what
have 25 people in the staff
what
now.
What have you done with that?
It's now housing. It's now Barrington housing.
Gotcha.
Because it's right next to the theater. So I think we're working more and more with the community. We're hiring a community engagement coordinator because one of the things we realize, Alan, is that we have our youth at risk program and certainly all of the kids that we know now come to the Wolfson Center. They come to North Street and we have the classes there. But we have to get into the community. We're not reaching everyone. We need to go into the community to see how we can help them, what their challenges are.
So, a couple questions. First of all, I know how I feel about this place, WMCA. I often say, you know, I'm not retiring, and that's the way it is, and they'll have to carry me out.
I don't feel the same way.
You don't?
No, I don't.
What do you want to do?
Well, I want to keep on living. There's a world out there I haven't experienced yet.
So you'll quit?
I think the words resign. But eventually, not resign. I think I'll retire. I don't think the words resign. I think the words retire eventually. I'm not ready to do it now. I'll know when I'm ready. When I slow down, when I start talking slower, Alan, you're going to say she's ready.
Yeah.
I still have a lot of work to do. And we're just now really getting into the community. I think our work on new plays is very important. And I'm so excited.
I hope not. I can tell you something.
What?
I can tell you something. I knew this guy. He was a doctor. And he had a hospital in the Bronx. And he was a bit of a Franz Fanon. I don't know if you would lecture his staff and say, when you carry me out of here, I'll know that it's time and you'll be right. So when they carried him out of there, he said, not yet.
Really? So you're going to stay?
I agree with you. I agree with you. You'll know when it's
there.
There comes a time. Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I have five grandchildren. I'm about to have a sixth. And I want to spend time with my family and my wonderful husband, who's been so patient. Let's face it. Norman Boyd is the most patient.
He may be the best person in the world.
He is.
Right up there.
We just know this. And he's been so patient. He loves the theater. He loves what we do. And, I mean, he has many patients in the entertainment field, too, in New York. So he knows this world. He knows the world of theater and film and so forth.
Do you send him anybody?
Well, when somebody asks for a dentist in New York, what do you think, I'm dumb? If someone says, do you know a dentist in New York, would I say no?
I love it. So the first thing is, we could count on your being there for a while longer, I would hope.
I think
yeah,
so.
I would hope. Secondly, you have this great collaborator, Marianne Quinson. Do you expect that she'll be with you down the line?
Marianne moved up in 2013 to be chair, and we have a board president now, Marita Glott, who's very active. And so I think the team is so unbelievably strong. Marita takes care of the day-to-day things, and Minky, Marianne, is the board chair. So I'm fortunate enough to have both of them. And plus, you know, one of the great things people know is my board is fabulous. I have an unbelievably exciting board, and they believe in what we're trying to do wholeheartedly. And I try to remind them of the importance of what we're doing in Pittsfield as much as I can, because I think that if you're not there day to day, you know the same thing. If people aren't there day to day, they don't really know what it's like, what you're doing day to day and how difficult it is. And, oh, wow, I just accomplished that. That's great. Oops, that didn't work. You know,
have you ever had a board member who, you know, didn't work out? Tell the truth.
No, not that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly not since we've been in Pittsfield.
Yeah.
No, I mean, most people, you know, it's a 3-year term. Most people stay more than 3 years. But sometimes people are just busy. You know, if they move on in their job or something like that, somebody might rotate off. But it's a pretty exceptional board. We also have a community advisory board of local people who I meet with to get advice from. I just need advice sometimes, and I don't know what's happening in the community as much as I'd like to sometimes, and so I try to use them.
So, Julie, you think Pittsfield is getting better?
I think Pittsfield's getting better. I can tell by the number of restaurants sometimes. There are more restaurants.
Some open and some closed.
Yeah, but this year more opened. Mm-hmm. You're right, but this year more opened. I think it is. I think Mayor Tyer is trying to do a great job, and she's understanding what the problems are. And I think that we're just all working together. I mean, it feels like the city is working with all of us. And well, that's the beginning, right?
Well, I hope from your mouth to God's ear, I'll tell you right now.
It's been a slow process, yes. I have to tell you. When we moved there in 2006, I thought, oh, a couple of years, this town will be thriving. It isn't, although I must say that we bring in 60,000 people a year to Barrington Stage. Yes. It's a lot of people into town, a lot of gas that's bought, a lot of restaurants, food that's eaten, you know. I think we bring in, I think it's something like, I don't know. There's some sort of a scale.
The so-called multiplier effect.
Multiplier. Thank you. It's like we bring in $4.5 million worth of business to Pittsfield, maybe more. But, I mean, it's a lot. And I think that the restaurants and the stores realize that. And I always say to the actors on the first day of rehearsal, when you go into a store, smile and say, hey, I'm from Barrington Stage. Let people know that you're going to these stores. And we always give everyone Barrington T-shirts, and so people know that we're around.
So, Julie, what's in the future?
That's a big question. You know, sometimes I think I just want to get through the year, but I think more new plays, more new work, more relevant work, you know, because I think that's where we are right now. I'm always trying to stay in tune with what's happening in the country.
But you're a gutsy lady. You take on things that, you know, may be a little bit hard for some people to swallow.
Well, you know, we do the gutsier things in our stage two, which has 136 seats. Our main stage is 520 seats. So we'll do like Into the Woods, you know, the James Lapine, Stephen Sondheim. So one of the things our artistic director has to do is sort of know where to program things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things. I think we have an audience who likes the gutsiness. They don't want to see, many of them are New Yorkers or Bostonians who see a lot of theater. And even the people from Berkshires go into a New York, or they certainly go to a lot of places around here that have exciting theater and other performing arts. So it's a sophisticated audience, and our local audience is growing too. When we started, our local audience was 9%. It's 29% now.
Wow.
And it doesn't mean just Pittsfield. It means the larger Berkshire community. So I think we're going to be doing more community work. We have a play scheduled. Rachel Lynette, this wonderful playwright who did a play last year called Well-Intentioned White People, was taken by the large homelessness rate in Pittsfield, was taken aback, I should say, and she wrote a play about homelessness, which we hope to offer for free next year to the community. We just have to figure out where we're going to do it.
Okay.
So that's sort of it, Alan. We're not bored at Barrington Stage.
Julie, you are a wonder. We've been talking to Julianne Boyd, co-founder and artistic director of Barrington Stage Company, now in their incredible and congratulations 25th season. Thank you, Julianne.
My pleasure, Alan.